radio station. Ideal candidates will have nonprofit management experience, the ability to thrive and work collaboratively in a decentralized organization, and the ability to delegate, plan, and organize people to meet goals and objectives. If this interests you, please go to kboo.fm/stationmanagerhire2013.
Tune in to Plugged In every first and third Fridays from 10 p.m. to midnight with host DJ Tronic. Tronic does a live mix in the studio featuring the latest in house, techno, tech house, breaks, dubstep, and more. Tronic also has guest DJs in the studio and often talks about upcoming parties, club nights, and more. That's Plugged In every first and third Fridays at 10 p.m. only on KBOO Portland.
This is Justin Miller. Join me on Friday, December 20th at 11 a.m. when my guest will be renowned author Salman Rushdie, speaking about his latest work, Joseph Anton, a memoir, an intimate look at his life in hiding after the publication of the Satanic Verses. Salman Rushdie talks about how he viewed the threats of radical fundamentalism against artists and art, his classic American immigration experience, and how WikiLeaks, Manning, and Snowden fit into the global struggle for free speech. That's Salman Rushdie this Friday at 11 a.m. online at kboo.fm and on your community radio station, KBOO.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
It's 8:04 a.m. and you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Lisa Loving, and today, where does your family resolve conflicts? Okay, and then where do our city leaders resolve conflicts? How do we leverage the family values, real family values, that we have in building our communities? And what are the dangers of relying on really smart guys sitting next to each other to solve our problems? Do you ever have a problem with really smart people sitting next to each other and patting each other on their back for being so brainy? And do the problems get solved? Kara Oregon. Anyway, we are live in Studio 2 with Renaud Catalani from the City of Portland. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thank you, Lisa.
And Marion Sharp, who does something really amazing at Portland State University. And we're going to go to that in a second. We're going to be talking about kitchen table cultures and learning how to share our real family values, especially as we're watching our communities change. Marion, I need to go to you and say, describe what you do at Portland State, because you've got a lot of stuff on your pizza. I'm saying that.
That I do. One of the most exciting things that I do, I think, is that I manage a program called Interpersonal Neurobiology. which is a very interesting term to think about those two words sitting next to each other. The other programs I manage are therapy with adoptive and foster families and an infant toddler mental health graduate certificate, which all also share interest in interpersonal neurobiology. And then the other thing that I do at Portland State is that I coordinate the social sustainability colloquium on campus, which in my mind is another example of how interpersonal neurobiology manifests in the world, because it's not just at the individual level, it's at the interpersonal level, which then expands out to communities and and beyond.
Interpersonal neurobiology is where, okay, perhaps say you've had a gigantic crisis situation in your life that changed you, and you thought, oh my God, I'm going to be changed by this forever. I'm never going to get away from it. And in interpersonal neurobiology is the new study of how to change that. Am I saying that right? So that people right now who are sitting there thinking, I've got a problem, I've got a social problem, a mental health problem, I'm never going to ever be able to change it. You're basically saying, look at these other options that we have. Talk about that a little bit. And it actually hits people's daily personal life. As we talk about on this show, mental health is a spectrum. We weave in and out of it our whole lives long. So talk about that.
Right. And it certainly fits with the idea of the kitchen table. We come into this world with, as infants, with potentials. And those potentials get activated, those potentials in our brain, the wiring circuitry in our brain gets activated by the interactions we then have with the people who are around us. So our parents, caregivers, extended family, siblings, that kind of thing, all of those shape our brain. When we have a severe traumatic event, that likewise shapes our brain. I spent years as a therapist. I used to do a lot of work around abuse, sexual abuse, things along those lines. And at that point in time, the feeling was we can kind of help people move forward and compensate, but we didn't have the sense that they could literally heal, that they could literally, in a sense, get past it. And with this new, based on science, with this new work that's out there, repair is in almost every case possible. There's sometimes some physiological, neurological damage that happens. And even then, sometimes the brain rewires around it. But in some cases, that can't. But much of the trauma, we really are able to heal, and we do it through relationships. That's how that kind of repair process happens. And that can happen at the, once again, at the individual level, at the kind of couples relationship level, at a community level. I was a family systems therapist for a long time. You know, that was our concept, was we look at the whole family system, not, kind of zero in on one or two people as the problem. It was a family systems issue. So
this strikes me as being one of these proactive ideas, these proactive ideas for solving the kinds of illnesses, all sorts of illnesses, physical and mental illnesses that we suffer in this country. Right. I mean, going back, well, how many years we got? What is it, 400 something years? I'm not, but when you just said, Marion Sharp, that people can be healed through relationships, you're freaking me out. What do you mean by that?
Well, we are shaped through relationships. Our identities, our experiences, our brains are literally wired through relationships. That's for good or ill. So if we have serious trauma, that is wiring our brains in particular ways that we will then have to repair through relationships, healthy relationships, that literally makes changes in the brain. It wires things differently. And, we had a strategy as family systems of reframing, and there would be points at which someone would reframe something for me, and all of a sudden I could literally, it was like I could feel my brain reconfigure itself, and all of a sudden I went, oh, Okay, so now that doesn't bother me so much anymore because I'm looking at it from a different perspective. But it was through that relationship and that different way of talking about it that really made a huge difference. You have kids who have come from serious trauma who move into foster care or into adoption. Their families see, their new families see their behavior as, in some cases, bizarre. And however, if you begin to understand the functionality of those behaviors, how it in fact has helped them survive some really terrible circumstances, then as the foster parent, adoptive parent, therapist, you begin to see that behavior differently. And instead of, in a sense, telling them they're bad because they're doing these things, you go, what a creative person you are to have come up with that solution to surviving that particular situation. And that completely reframes how the person experiences that and begins to open the door for, you know, maybe that helped you survive then. Maybe right now it's creating some problems, but you're kind of trapped in the habit of doing things that way, and maybe we can work through that and come up with some new strategies. And so, then if you think about that at the cultural level, it just opens up all kinds of possibilities.
Listeners, and that's where we're going to go to. So we're looking at mental health, personal health, physical and mental health, although we're talking about how the mind works right now. And we're talking about people being able to heal your own self. And then we're taking that whole frame and we're going to just chuck it at City Hall. I don't mean to be a weirdo. We could chuck it at the feds. I'm not ready to go there, okay? We could just look at City Hall, which we have had this discussion the past few weeks on this show, where the municipal, the government that's closest to you is the government that does the most for you or against you. It depends on how you look at it or how it impacts you. And that's why we also here have at our table here in Studio 2, we have Renaud Catalani from the City of Portland. And can you describe a little bit how this issue of, affects what we're seeing on the city level where we're looking at City Hall? I saw an article this week about Charlie Hales and the city's homelessness issues, the sit-lie ordinance, and now the state legislature is going to take that and vote on whether local jurisdictions are allowed to have their own homelessness policies, houselessness policies, sit-lie ordinance-style policies. And Charlie Hales' spokesperson, Dana Haynes, basically told Christian Gaston, the Oregonian reporter, that the city of Portland does not have a homelessness policy, a homeless policy. And we who read that, we made that face, the scream, like that painting, the scream. This is me making that face. Because the city has been working for decades on this issue. And so I'm just bringing that up because that's the one that really got me. And here is Renaud Catalani. He's looking at how many parts of City Hall, how many parts of city government do not welcome all of the communities that now live here. And so they stumble, our city leaders stumble through making these decisions because they don't have all the brains at the table. So that was a big windup. Can you talk a little bit about this issue and how it strikes you?
That's a big windup. Thank you.
It's a big windup. My arm's tired now.
Thank you, Lisa, for having Professor Sharp and me here. It's still dark outside. Thank you for this hour program. Yes, this is how I look at it. You know, my work is immigrant and refugee integration. That's only half of it. The other part of my work is integrating the mainstream into our communities because we are not going to live together and because Portland is 1 in 5 foreign-born. That is to say, out of 500,000 people, 100,000 of us were not born here. This is not counting our kids. As you know, about half of Portland Public School are ethnic minority children. So we can see where the future is, where the future is going. And where the future is going is towards a more socio-cultural complexity that we're simply not at yet today. So my take on all this is I grew up, and many of the folks I sit with every Sunday and Saturday and at happy hours grew up in very complex socio-cultural settings. That is to say, you know, my earliest memories are of German sea captains and jostling Filipino sailors, Chinese merchants, my elder auntie, who's a shaman, my grandpa, who's a very martial manado, a soldatu, we call it soldier, and my mom setting the table and expecting civility from all of us, from all of us. So we grow up, and by we, I mean all the A groups, you know, Arabs, Asians, Americano, Latinos, Africans, in a very complicated world that creates different kinds of neural pathways of the kind that Professor Sharp has just described. That is to say, if we're sitting every Sunday together, expecting everyone to be aware of the social and emotional needs of everyone packed around that table, we're even asking this of children, we're asking this of teenagers, we're asking this of parents and of grandparents, then you create a kind of neural mapping that accommodates much more complexity in a much kinder way than if we grow up in a very homogenous culture, whether it's Japanese culture or American culture, or pick your group, where there's just not a lot of ages, social streams, cultural streams, participating in conversation.
We're sort of siloed. We're listening to Lars Larson, or people are listening to Lisa Loving. Probably we have a lot more in common than we have in opposition.
That's within that bubble. And so I think the problem is that is problem solving. You know, we're all problem solvers. We solve a child's tears. We solve a teenager's dramas. We solve adult problems at a global scale. Now, how ready are we to sit down with a variety of folks who see those problems in very, very different ways? And how ready are we to talk to each other, to listen to each other, and to come to an accord that may not be that one that the very well-educated, well-dressed, well-paid, well-fed folks do? Our policy leaders, essentially, whether it's in City Hall in Portland or in Salem or in Washington, D.C. The complexity of the problem solving is just not at the complexity of the problems we have today. And in here somewhere, then, there's overlap between what Professor Sharp and I are talking about, from the individual to the familial to the communal to the national issues.
Listeners, how does your family resolve conflicts? Can we make that work for the city? I just want to hear people call and talk about this issue. 503-231-8187. It reminds me of something that a caller named Michael, who's often a more conservative caller, said a few weeks ago. We had someone on the air talking about mental health. It was mental health first aid. That's what it was, which is an awesome program. And he said, you know, sometimes people need to help themselves before they can help the other people around them. And I could actually agree with that on a lot of levels. But listeners, of course, 503-231-8187. We're cruising through the Chrismica season, talking about our Festivus celebrations. This is some of the time that we all have the most conflict, whether it's at the city level or the federal level or our house level. So how are you resolving conflicts? I'd love to hear that. I came from a family where we don't. You know, classic white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. You've got a problem? No, you just shut up. You don't bring other people down with that. You deal with it. And even when I don't want to keep living through that, I see my family having the same issues as well. Even when I feel as though I've never, ever said that to anyone, I don't know where it comes from. It's like a fug. It just flies over me and around my people somehow. So how do you solve problems? 503-231-8187. Professor Sharp, I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about interpersonal neurobiology. I mean, that's also something when we're looking at a lot of other, even smaller issues, like trying to remap our own minds. Can you talk a little bit about how that touches? I know a lot of people listening are people that have been through conflict and people that feel like they have post-traumatic stress syndrome and stuff like that. Can you talk a little bit more about what the promise is for this field? Because everywhere I've read about it, it's described as new. And at your certificate program at Portland State, is it 3 years old?
We started in 2005, so okay. It's been around around a little while. And the, in essence, the field of interpersonal neurobiology, Dan Siegel at UCLA is the one who kind of coined the phrase and started talking about it. And so he's been doing that since earlier than, obviously, than the 2005. And we rely on a lot of his work and a lot of the colleagues that have worked with him. And I'm not a professor at Portland State. I'm an academic professional, so I manage continuing ed programs there. I just wanted to clarify that piece.
I know, because we're back to that place of what's your degree
exactly.
And what's your certification, and
right.
Sometimes we stumble over that, but go
right,
ahead.
Right.
Go ahead.
And so it's like I've got all of these thoughts that are going through my head, but I just wanted to, almost as an example of conflict and how this can get transformed through relationships. I had the great good fortune to get randomly picked through Healthy Democracy for a Citizens Initiative Review panel that looks at some of the ballot measures, and spent a week in Salem processing one of the ballot measures. And, it's not even relevant which one it is. The process was what was so incredibly important. And the very first day of that process, in the morning, so the first half of the first day, we went into kind of a simulation of what the process was going to be like. And I had been sitting next to a gentleman who was very nice, and we had had some conversation, and then we got into the small group. And as we were processing this simulation, he started saying some things using some language that triggered for me the recognition that he was of a different point on the political spectrum than I was, a very distant point from where I was on the political spectrum.
I'm looking at your face, and yes, it's funny. Go ahead.
Yes, and my instinct at that point was to stop listening and to distance myself from this person and to start thinking, oh my gosh, I've got to spend a whole week, and how is this going to turn out, and all of that kind of thing. But because of the process, the instructions were to, in a sense, stay in listening mode, stay in learning mode. And so we were instructed to continue to listen. So as he finished what he was saying, he got to the end, and all of a sudden, I went, oh my God, I agree with him. And it's like, how is that possible that I could possibly agree with someone who is this far out on the spectrum? And it's like, we became very good friends during that time, and stayed connected through that whole time. And it was just, it blew me away. And that was one of those instantaneous transformations that would never have happened had there not been the relationship and kind of the setting, this public setting, in which there were some kind of civility rules, process rules about, stay in learning mode, stay in listening mode, and hear the whole thing. And I realized, our normal mode is you stop listening as soon as you hear something you don't like.
Right.
Prepare an argument.
Yes.
Already
yes.
Starting to do that. Right. I'm already starting to shut the door. We had this happen on this show last week numerous times, and that's a fascinating concept as well. So let's go to the phone lines. We got a full slate. We've got Tony on the phone. Tony, what's on your mind? What are you thinking about today?
Well, this is a huge topic you've taken on today, combining the two, the interpersonal and then the city council. So I have two comments, and one is, with the city, I think what you're talking about would work great, but I don't know if everybody comes to the table, campaign donors and things like that. I don't, the real powers of the city, do they come to the table to talk with the other people at the table? And then how does conflict get resolved if not everybody's at the table?
Yeah, keep going. You had another question, I think.
Yeah, well, just a comment is, on this, I can't remember the name of your speaker, I'm a teacher, elementary music teacher, and I teach this method. It's called Music Adventures. But we work with the children using folk songs, play, listening, speaking, to do this very thing where the kids actually resolve their conflicts with each other through play and learning how to listen and talk.
Mm, that's fascinating.
Wow. Yeah, it's great. And I work a lot with disadvantaged kids, elementary kids out in Gresham. So anyway, those are my two comments. I don't know how they're related, but that's what
I don't either. This one fascinates me. Thanks, Tony. This is like a web to me. It's like a web of ideas that we're looking at. And whenever mm-hmm. we have Renaud Catalani on the air, the show's going to be complicated. And he just looks and he says, you know, life is complicated. There's nothing wrong with that. What were you doing anyway, watching TV?
Right.
No, he doesn't actually say that, but I think that's his point, actually.
Yeah,
I'm putting words into his head. Tony, thanks for calling.
And Tony, I would just like to suggest that you consider working on a curriculum that takes what you've learned in working with your kids and then says, well, let's do this with adults and see what happens.
Tony, that would be really fun, actually.
Actually, I have done it with adults, but thank you for your comment.
Yeah,
thank you.
I think Tony has said the two things that we've been trying to say over and over again in many, many ways. One is the complexity of the players at the table, that everyone is there. And secondly, that there is a with Professor Sharp, and you have to excuse me for saying that, but you know, in our culture, if you're a teacher, you're a teacher.
You're very
professorial. You're a professor. If you're a doctor,
I'm not sure that's good.
You're a doctor, so it's a gesture of our respect for your
right.
learning.
This is the conversation. That's just fascinating because what
yes.
you're just saying now is a microcosm of the whole point we're making.
Right.
But keep
right.
going.
And then the second thing would be what Professor Sharp's called the process that brings folks together, the rules we play by, and we call that civility, or we call that good manners, or we call that traditional ways of being with each other.
Can we call it cultural competency on the city level? Can we call it that? Is it the same thing?
I think you can, but it's not.
Not necessarily
it's not
the
even,
same thing.
It's not even that, because
okay.
we learn. I have a granddaughter now who's 3, and we expect her at the table to participate like a 3-year-old. That is to be responsible for the social and for the emotional harmony of the group. Each and every person is responsible for the social harmony of the group. So you're not going to interrupt the gentleman with the political position different from yours. You're just not. That's not creating harmony. That's creating conflict.
Right.
If we're going to sit together of different ages, different genders, homeowners, renters, homeless, folks of different sexual and love orientations, we can't be interrupting each other. We have to all be responsible for the harmony of the group. Now, it's true in my country, Indonesia, we have 700 languages. We don't get as much done as Americans do. But we really enjoy each other's company. We overeat. We laugh like children. We cry like babies. But the goal, the point is to create this communal whole. And you don't get as much done. You know, in America, airplanes go up in the air. The gas tank is always full. The tires are always full. At the end of the day, the banks zero out. It's terrific.
I don't know if we get as much done as we think. I really don't. I think that in the United States, we spin our wheels a lot. I really, truly
I think that's
do.
True.
And we use a lot of fuel, and then we have to go put more gas in the gas
yes.
tanks. So this is Wednesday Talk Radio. We're in deep conceptual waters this morning. We're looking at this concept of interpersonal neurobiology, and we're also looking at just like, how do we resolve issues as people? How do we resolve conflicts in our families? How do we resolve conflicts in the city council? We're just pulling that one out today, city council level. And we're seeing our communities change right under our feet. Some of us don't want to deal with that or accept it. But the question that we have on the table right now is, how does your family resolve conflicts? We just really want to hear those stories. And can it work for the city? That's what we're asking. 503-231-8187. And we have Joanne on the phone. Joanne, what do you think?
I can't help you, folks. I come from a broken family of 4. My daughter was on the run for 5 years. We got together in Portland finally in 1999. And we're still broken. And the county, the city, the state, the nonprofits haven't even helped us live in one place. So we can start work on being a family, let alone a healthy family. And one more thing, I'm kind of worn out getting ready for a mouse vent cleaning on our building. My traumatized brain of 70-something years, how can my traumatized brain heal when everybody uses technology in their home, at work, the doctors, the dentists, everybody uses technology of and computers, and they're everywhere, and cell phones on the bus and grocery store, everybody's driving vehicles. How can my traumatized brain heal? Are you kidding? Goodbye.
Joanne is awesome. Joanne, she's got the bubbling pots. She stuck a bunch of them on the table. I hadn't even thought to ask this issue about the technology. It's totally in the way. And as she's saying that, I'm typing on my computer, feeling funky about that. Can you address that? So Joanne, she's one of my favorite big aunties, to be honest with you, calling up on this show. She always puts some of the biggest issues on the table, and yet she herself, she struggles to be able to build community around herself. What should we be doing?
Well, one of the things that I immediately kind of started thinking about is that and I'm 65, so I hate admitting that. But so, you know, I've been around a while. But one of the stories that Dan Siegel tells is about working with a gentleman, one of his clients, who was in his 90s and worked with him for quite a while on working through some of the issues that he had experienced over his long life. And at some point, the man's wife called Dan and said, "Okay, he has really changed. What did you do? Give him a brain transplant or something?" So even in his 90s, this person was able, through the relationship with Dan Siegel, through the therapy that he had gotten. Now, I mean, this is not what Joanne, because Joanne's talking about, they're not resources and that kind of thing, but the age doesn't matter. We can still change no matter how old we are. And we do it through the relationship. So I wanted to make that point in particular that, you know, the possibility is there no matter, you know, where we are in our lifespan. But there have to be relationships. And if there are not resources, odds are, I mean, it sounds like Joanne actually has a relationship with the show, with you.
Mm-hmm.
So she has relationships, and through those relationships, there are possibilities, but more relationships that are based on kind of a healthy approach to attachment, a healthy understanding of trust and connection. Then those kinds of things can actually, you know, families can heal.
And I want to say Dan Siegel is kind of the father of interpersonal neurobiology. It's a concept we're talking about this morning. It's a concept in therapy. It looks like it's used in a variety of applications. Listeners, how do you resolve conflicts in your family? How does your family do that? Do you not do it? I'd like to hear your story anyway. 503-231-8187. And we have a caller. We have Bridget on the phone. Bridget, what's going on with you?
Well, good morning to begin with, and I really, really want to thank you, Lisa. I think you are the best hosting program entirely on KBOO. Thank you, Professor Sharp, for all of your amazing information today. One final thing, I truly wish that I could meet Joanne someday. We could be friends. She is so gutsy and so bold and so interesting and so intelligent and fiery. I like Joanne. Good day, everyone. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bridget. You know, Joanne, maybe we need to bring you down here for, KBOO's having a Festivus party. We're having a holiday party this Saturday. People should feel welcome to come down here. And Joanne, I've met Joanne before, and she is very feisty. And I'm coming back to this fascinating issue of what are the obstacles for us getting in the way and supporting each other. I've heard plenty of callers call up and love Joanne over the years. I have, but it's not enough. So how do we get what we need? And you were going to say something.
We'll get closer to what we need by setting the table properly. You know, by you are welcoming Joanne and embracing her and listening carefully to what she brings and giving her her face and her place. That's her chair. No fear, no worry, no anxiety. You'll always be at our table, Joanne. And I've watched and listened to you do this many, many times on this program and in other settings, whether it's at Scanner or at KBOO, where once we get folks out of that fear that they are not going to be given their dignity, given their place, right? We can't all rule. We can't all be in charge. We just have a seat at a table. But we are belonging to this table. And once we can relax into that sense of belonging and being cared for and given our dignity, that sets the table for problem solving. But without that, what Professor Sharp has described as a process in her work, and what we describe as civility or just good manners, old world ways of working with each other, without that fundamentally at the table, I don't know how to proceed.
I would like to bring this conversation then back around to these issues with the city of Portland we're seeing, and I don't want to attack people right now. I just don't feel like doing that. I don't feel like doing that today. But it is a concern that we all have, that we've all been involved in social change, positive social change. Many of us for like decades in this town, there are fewer people of color in leadership positions in City Hall in general than there were a generation ago. Significantly fewer. There weren't very many at the time. People will tell you that Portland is the whitest city in the country. Actually, only if you cut those numbers in a certain way do you get that. It's not really if you go to the census and say these are the top 50 whitest cities in the country. It's not on that list. You have to crunch the numbers a certain way, and I don't mean to be rude about it. There's plenty of people of color in this town, and it worries me to see how people are erased. And when you hear people talk about, oh, it's such a white town, that's always a justification for something that I don't want to agree with. I just hear it coming. So Samsu Bedi, right, this wonderful guy, I can't remember where Sam is from.
He's from Bhutan.
And he, we have a commentary on the Scanner right now talking about the work he has done with what's called the Portland World Cup Soccer Project. And it involves bringing like dozens and dozens of immigrant young people. I'm not even sure. I don't think that's the right word to use to describe these young people.
Well, he's bringing in families.
There you go.
Elisa, not just kids. And that's
wrapping
a different...
Around. Talk about them a little bit, though. But what he's doing is he's bringing people into City Hall, physically bringing people into City Hall who maybe would not have seen themselves there. The people who work in City Hall would not have seen people coming from all over the world necessarily who live here coming into City Hall. And he's showing these people what, like, employment opportunities. They're meeting people, getting at each other's business cards. Talk a little bit about what social change, like, what does it look like? And you can talk about Mr. Subedi, mm-hmm. who's actually emerging as a wonderful writer in our community now. I don't know how many languages he speaks. It's very difficult to do that. So talk a little bit about that, like just literally setting the table for all the people that we want to be in charge of this stuff.
Well, Som is a superman, of course, but Som is just one of a larger family of folks who make these things happen, and they're actually our Mutual Assistance Association.
And we had the uncles on this show right. A few weeks ago. We hope to have the big aunties on sometime.
So we want to resist, as new Americans, this idea that an individual makes things magically occur. Earlier this week, I was featured as a Know Your City Comics for Change superhero. And it was embarrassing for me because, you know, I set the table. That's what I do. The heavy lifters around the table get the work done. So for us as new Americans, as old worlders, to be thought of in these individual terms is really frightening. I mean, we get all the glory of the success, of course, but it's also the risk of failure.
It's kind of also not the whole story.
It's not the whole story. So he is super duper, but his work is after the work of Alejandro Vidales. And the work is not, and this is again old world characterization, not an American one. It's not about helping youth. It's about our families. And that's what our work is aimed at. We don't have this concept of teenagers behaving or misbehaving all on their own. And we don't like the idea of serving them all on their own. It's all familial. A healthy, happy family is a healthy and happy teenager. We can't make those kinds of distinctions. And this gets us all back to where I think we started this conversation. You have to have at the table the grandpas, the parents, the aunties, the uncles, the younger sisters and younger brothers. Everyone together then works together for the communal welfare. not for one age group or one social group or one educational group. And, despite, I don't know, Professor, you can help me with 3 or 4 decades of research on what's called groupthink, that is the very handsome Kennedys getting together with their Ivy League, super-educated, well-dressed folks, sitting together in the White House solving problems got us into a terrible fight in Cuba and a terrible fight in Vietnam that took decades of misery and bitterness to get over. It's because they were sitting together, these educated white fellas. Really good looking, they're the best, really. But the complexity simply isn't there. And they were thinking about the world as they saw it, and no one interrupted them because there wasn't anyone at the table to do so. So Som is doing a terrific job. Of course he is. And it has to be seen, though, as a large part of a much, much bigger picture where we're using football. And most refugee kids, whether Somalis or Nepalis or Rwandans, play football all day long. In a refugee camp, there is nothing to do but play football. So they're great soccer players. He's using that as a hook. We're using that as a hook for boys and girls. But it's a larger picture of getting them into City Hall in front of City Council, seeing themselves, as respectable, dignified, well-dressed kids. It has to do with career days at the Fire Bureau, at the Police Bureau, at the Parks Bureau, looking at finding ways to get them a pathway into city employment and so on and so on and so on. So soccer's the hook. The family is the grab, and I believe last year we had 24 teams from 24 ethnic and national groups, including American Indians, play on July 4th for the Portland World Cup. And it was Alejandro's terrific work, 327 families, Más y Menos, who he brought in. Kids from the most vulnerable neighborhoods in the far, far, far east end of town, in the north, north end of town. Terrific work.
This is Wednesday Talk Radio. We are talking about how do we leverage family values, real family values, in building our communities. I'm just putting that out. I think that's what we're talking about right now. And we're live in the studio with Renault Catalani and Marion Sharp. Marion, you wanted to say something.
Right. One of the, just playing off of what we were just talking about, is that within the, trying not to say the academic world, but that is where it's kind of home-based, there is a new approach to doing research that is referenced as community-based participatory research. And it is an approach to research that really challenges all of our traditional ways of doing research, where you have the experts come in and, they set up the study and, and anybody who's part of it is really just, they're the subjects or something along those lines. With community-based participatory research, all of the people who are impacted by whatever the issue might happen to be, come together to create a study. They become co-researchers. So there may be the traditional approach to, how you get trained to be a researcher, but this is where they are across the board. And it challenges everybody because, the academics come in with their way of talking about things and nobody can understand them. They use words that nobody else uses. And so there becomes this, moment where that has to transform so that it is a true partnership that is coming. And the choice of the target of the research rests with the community instead of someone from outside the community saying, oh, you need help with this and this and this. Instead, it's the community saying, no, that's really not what our concerns are. Our concerns are this, and have that become, in fact, the focus of the study. So it is another way in which that concept, that way of thinking is moving into other fields. It's been around for a while. And
it's also a concept in civil rights organizing. I'm thinking of Six Sisters in Action for Power years ago. Some of the Mississippi summer stuff in the early 60s were like that. It's a very difficult path because the point is that who can control it? It becomes an issue of control. Control is the word that we're not talking about. It's the elephant in the room that we're not talking about. And as we're talking about, our goal would be something like to... I interviewed Dr. David Anthony this last week, who was one of my professors at the University of Oregon, and now he's a teacher at UC Santa Cruz. And he said, you know, people need to understand that not all the smartest people that have all the answers in this world think in English. Just that one thing, right? Anyway, we were talking about Nelson Mandela, but it goes to this thing of, for us, our goals, as I'm looking at the magical engineering pixie, we want our city to be run by people who look like the people that live in the city. Right. But the other people, that's not their goal. And so for other people, this clamp down and control is the strategy for being in control, if I'm saying that right. We want to change the paradigm so that it's the way we think it's fairer. And it's probably smarter to be able to plug in every brain.
It's
right?
More fun, that's for sure.
Yes. That's for sure.
Yes,
there's
absolutely.
Probably a lot of mixed drinks and food out there that we would not have heard of. So we do have another caller. We've got Jeremy on the phone. Jeremy, what's on your mind today?
Hi. Yeah. I haven't really disagreed with anything that anyone said, but I'm always nervous when people connected to universities in any way refer to, especially around brain science, because I think there's we're living in under the boot of a biopsychiatric paradigm that tells us that all this misery we're experiencing is somehow in our brain. And that we need to change our brains, ergo, you know, millions of people are being put on drugs. I realize that's not what she thinks, you know. The woman has suggested that things get better through relationships. But if someone, is experiencing, you know, horrible oppression at work and has no money, the relationship they need is social change. And that's what's going to give them more money. So I'm nervous about this reference to neuroscience as somehow, you know, providing proof of anything, since, you know, psychiatrists have been lying to us for years, and it seems like they've enlisted neurolinguistics and various other questionable disciplines, all of which to argue that we have broken brains, or our brains get broken by things that happen to us, and that we need to do is fix our brain. I think we need to fix our society.
Awesome,
I,
Jerry.
I realize ultimately nobody disagrees with me.
No, but I appreciate your underlining the real difficulty here, because I've been trying to pull this conversation over to the what are the obstacles, because, you know, we all want to throw rainbows and unicorns on stuff, but we're also talking about some of the nitty gritty here of what doesn't work. So I really want to thank you for calling, Jeremy.
I do have one other question, comment about,
yes,
about the whole racial divide. In Portland, I think we are still the whitest city over a half a million people, and the whitest, I'm not sure if we're the whitest metropolitan area, so, but I think you're actually wrong about that. I'm going to go check and make sure.
I'm saying but there's a qualifier. There's a qualifier in there, but
sure,
go ahead.
But I mean, it's still around, you know, 6 to 9% of the three major non-white groups. You know, it adds up to about 23 or 24. We're about 77% white still, and in my, you know, not terribly fancy, but still somewhat close in neighborhood, I think there's one black person on my block. So
right.
It is quite racialized.
I have to tell you, what it is to me is segregated. But I totally appreciate what you're saying, Jeremy, and I honor your call. And I love the points that you're bringing up. They're amazing. Okay. He put a couple fascinating pots on the stove there.
Important.
Can you... I want to go for that to talk a little bit about the racial numbers thing, because I appreciate Jeremy worrying about information. I worry about it too. I worry about people saying this is the whitest fill in the blank place, because we all know what the racism is like. In my mind, I think of it as this is a Ku Klux Klan stronghold from back in the day. People are trying to change it, but I don't know, can you talk about that a little? What's the most helpful way for us who want to see these things change in a positive way? What's the most helpful frame for us to put on this information?
Well, how the information is framed, as you've said earlier, how the information is framed and the qualifiers that go with it, I think are everything, because, you know, if one in five Portlanders is foreign-born, that's for this entire city. But I assure you, when I have a car with five people in it, we're all foreign-born. When we meet around our kitchen table on Sundays, I assure you it's more than one in five. It's more like, you know, all five out of five. So it depends
on... Looking at the segregation aspect of it.
Yes, what you've called segregation. If you go to East Portland and the farther and farther east you go outside of the city, we're seeing more and more ethnic minorities. Now, here's the other thing that we want to be clear about. About an eighth of our foreign-born are Russian speakers. And we don't have a good number on that because they're white. And the way America characterizes our differences in racial terms is, it's not fair, it's not
inadequate,
true.
It's not really, actually necessarily helpful.
It's actually paralyzing. You know, it's kind of ill. And it gets us stuck in a system of bitterness and guilt and paralysis. This is not only a racial matter. Russian-speaking families from any of the former Soviet states are suffering in the same way that Latino families are. One's white, one's brown. They have, you know, a teen pregnancy. They have methamphetamine use. We have high school dropout rates that are frightening. So we're going to have to look at it in a broader context of race, of ethno-cultural complexity, not just the color of our skin. Now, our family lives in Hawaii now, and my daughter lives in San Francisco, and, you know, you can't do the race thing anymore. It's just, well, you know, who's not hapa dis, hapa dat, you know? Wow. So we're going to have to discuss this in a broader term, and maybe the broader characterization of ethno-cultural complexity rather than race will also help us find solutions.
Mm-hmm. And have more fun.
Right. And one of the, in just playing off of what you're talking about, there's more richness in the conversation. There are more options, possibilities on the table for solutions when we stop and listen to the variety of perspectives that are there. And if we don't do that, then we shortchange ourselves, we shortchange our society, and that is a really troubling thing. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to say one thing in reference to Jeremy's call. I share deeply his concern around neuroscience. It's part of why the interpersonal getting added to it has helped me with this. I am probably completely opposed to medication as an approach. Now, medication helps. It does help. But that is not the solution to problems. The solution to problems come out of loving relationships, whether it's within the family, whether it's a therapeutic relationship, whether it's from the school, from a sports environment, whatever that is. It is the relationship that provides the base for people to grow and to heal. And, you know, when that relationship is bad, it's also the place where people get hurt. But the people who are doing the bad things came out of relationships that where those kinds of things were likely done to them. So we have to heal as a society, and we have to use every tool we can find, every piece of wisdom we can find from every source, which means opening ourselves up. I mean, we got excited about the neurobiology because finally, as therapists who did a soft science, we had hard science to back up what we were doing.
So you're beating yourselves up over the certification
thing
again.
Exactly.
It's like, is there a Kennedy at your table or not?
Yeah. And what's exciting, though, is the hard science finally caught up with us. At least that's how I like to think about it.
Don't you think about it hard or soft. Let go of that.
But it caught up with us and affirmed that which we knew, which I think affirms exactly what we've been talking about in terms of the wisdom of the cultures of the elders, and we need to pay attention to that.
How do we quantify information in the real world? So let's grab that last caller. We have LJ. LJ, what's going on, man?
Hey, Lisa, how are you?
Great.
thank you so much for the show. Lisa, this is a very interesting conversation, but all we're doing is verbalizing. All right, we have a serious problem in this city, and it's called houselessness, all right? The politicians are trying to solve this problem. Let's move them under the Broadway Bridge, and this way they'll be out of sight, and we'll let them live there for 12 months. That didn't work out. Now the new answer is, let's rent warehouse space at $10,000 a month and house 80 people so they can get a decent night's sleep for 15 months. Lisa, that's $150,000. I'm with the Elders Caucus of Occupy. We recognize the R2-D2 problem, and the immediate problem is to get people fed and to get people prepared to sleep in the winter under adverse conditions. So the Elders Caucus, in our wisdom, we had a sleeping bag and winter clothing drive, and we were able to raise some funds, and we got sleeping bags down to the R2-D2 folks and winter clothes, and we also got sleeping mats so people could get themselves up off the ground, yada, 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 yada. So anyway, for $150,000, I think the city could do a lot better than to shove people in a warehouse and get them out of sight.
LJ, I have to give you this strong recommendation. Israel Bear, right? He's the editor of Street Roots. He's got an extremely sophisticated, intelligent discussion about what the heck is going on with City Hall all of a sudden on this issue. I really recommend that people go read it because it goes back to the kitchen table where literally when Hales was elected, he just turned his back on many, many, many years
really?
of sitting down with people who were affected by this problem that... Sam Adams basically had been setting up all these systems, and we got to let you go.
I've been involved in this for a very long time. I worked on a project with Eric Sten.
LJ, got it. Eric Sten, so you're talking about 10 years ago.
End homelessness
in 10 years.
So Lisa, tell me what happened.
Bureaucracy. Don't have the right people around the table.
So can we talk about the Portland Business Alliance and the Portland Development Commission?
That's exactly where I'm going, LJ. That's exactly what I'm talking about. You are welcome, LJ. So when you look at, I really recommend people go to streetroots.org and read Israel's analysis about this. How are you going to solve the problem if you don't have all the people around the table? That's exactly what we're talking about. So we're running out of show. I do have to say, at 9 on Political Perspectives, Bruce Silverman is going to interview Lisa Gadsby and Peter Jenkins about their research on the drill, a very rare primate found in Africa. They're going to discuss their program for the breeding and conservation of the drills. Air Cascadia at 10:15, Flashpoints at 11. Chris Siegel and Peter Schoaf host the KBOO Food Show with guest Sandor Katz on fermentation. Dude, I'm doing this bread recipe around fermentation in the fridge. It is awesome. It's the best bread I ever made. Cheese Impresario, Barry Lynn. If you're listening to KBOO and there's a Cheese Impresario, turn it up. Just saying. So we are running out of show. I want to go around and ask Mr. Catalani, Professor Sharp, we're saddled with it now. Do you guys have events or ways that people can plug into what you're doing and participate with you or support your work?
Yes. Yeah, naturally. But let me have this closing word. I think Portland and many of our, all of our city commissioners, including our mayor, are very kind and careful.
They care
about
actually,
the kind of processes that we are participating in. Some people complain actually that Portland is a little process burdened, that the processes are too slow, and we're never quite coming to sharp decisions because of that. The only thing I would add to that, though, is that the participants in the process need to represent more energy.
All right.
And I do have the Social Sustainability Colloquium at PSU is on Friday afternoons from 2 to 4. Anyone can go to it. It is free. It's term-based, so it won't start again until, I think, maybe the 10th or of January.
I'll try to get that information out there. And that's it for our show. Thanks to our guests, Reno Catalani and Marion Sharp. Special thanks to engineer Steve Nasser and Sky, the studio dog. This show will be podcast on KBOO.fm by the end of today. Grab that link and share it with your friends and family. I'm Lisa Leving. Follow me on Twitter for more news and information about the topics we discuss on this show. Theme music by the March 4th Marching Band. Stay tuned for Political Perspectives.
Hey, KBOO supporters, we just sent you a card, so watch your mailbox. It's an opportunity to give a little more assistance at this time of year to your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio station. Yep, tax time. That means that your donation makes a difference, and it'll really make a difference for KBOO because you can help us qualify for Oregon Cultural Trust matching funds. You can get more information about this on our website at kboo.fm/year-end-gift-2013.
What we're going to do is throw a lot of banana peels around Chicago and have the machine stumble.
I had a dream that the only reason the employers were so powerful was that we were weak.
There's this myth that black people did not resist until Watts or until the Black Panther Party. It's just not true.
Tune in, turn on, and remember is a monthly special program on the history of KBOO Community Radio, commemorating KBOO's 45th anniversary year. The last installment of this special series will be on December 24th at 6 p.m. And listen online to the full series at kboo.fm/tune-in-turn-on.
Good morning, it's 9:01. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. And coming right up on Political Perspectives, host Bruce Silverman interviews Portland native Liza Gadsby. She's part of a team who were the first people to do research on the drill, which is a very rare primate found in Africa. They'll discuss their program for the breeding and conservation of drills. At 10 o'clock, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, activist and author Harvey Wasserman brings us an update on the continuing nuclear meltdown at Fukushima and a victory for those fighting the building of a massive new military base on pristine Jeju Island in South Korea. And at 11 o'clock, Chris Siegel and Peter Schoaf host the KBOO Food Show with guest Sandor Katz on fermentation and also cheese impresario Barry Lynn. And a big thank you to KBOO members for your great support for community radio. And if you're not a KBOO member, you can become one now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. We go right now to Political Perspectives.
Good morning. This is Bruce Silverman. My guest today is Liza Gadsby. She's a native of Portland, but for the last, I think almost 25 years, she has been in Nigeria.